couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Knives Out, Queen and Slim, The Two Popes, and a look back at Motherless Brooklyn and the new Netflix animated film, or Klaus. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the 1979 horror thriller by John Frankenheimer, Prophecy, new on Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
When it comes to the news, there's a piece that I was going to talk about last week. I don't think I had enough time to talk about it, and that's the fact that Noah Hawley has been tapped for Star Trek IV. What's interesting about this is Noah Hawley, he's mostly a script guy. He's written several scripts, and he worked a lot in TV. His big directorial debut was Lucy in the Sky, which came out... oh gosh, what, about a month or two ago? And it was a huge flop, a massive flop. And it was raked across the coals by critics, and audience didn't see it. I reviewed it on the show. I gave it a terrible rating. It's not a good movie. And what's interesting about this is him getting this opportunity to do the next Star Trek movie, which, first of all, is not as good of an opportunity as you think it is. More on that in a minute. But it plays into that narrative that men fail upward in Hollywood. And I'm sure there's a certain degree of that happening. But there is a narrative that women never get an even break, that women, when they have a flop, the flop haunts them forever. One of the big examples is Elaine May, who directed the notorious flop in 1987, Ishtar. That movie ruined her directorial career. She still worked as a script person. She still wrote in Hollywood, but she never got another directorial debut, and now she's going to be directing something with Dakota Johnson, and that's kind of made some news. And everyone says, well, why does Elaine May, why did she get raked over the coals? And the reason she got raked over the coals is because Ishtar was such a financial and famous flop. It was like over $50 million for the budget of that movie, and we're talking 1987, where I don't know, five or six movies that year made $50 million. These were huge numbers back then. Now, I mean, a $50 million movie is kind of disposable, and because of the emerging marketplace overseas, there's a lot of opportunity with the DVD and Blu-ray and streaming, and there's a lot of other ancillary opportunities. But back in 1987, there was your theatrical market and maybe home video and cable and television even. And that was about it. The reality is, and I talked about this, I think, a little bit in recent weeks, in terms of the gender politics of Hollywood, it's not whether a movie flops. It's whether a movie is a notorious flop. Take, for example, Heaven's Gate, which was Michael Cimino's follow-up to The Deer Hunter, which was a big movie, won him the Academy Award, and then he did Heaven's Gate, and it flopped. And it was notorious for being extremely huge budget-wise and costing a lot of money, and they did not get their money back. And that's the kind of thing that ruins careers. And yes, Michael Cimino continued to work in Hollywood, but in a much smaller capacity than he did before. Or you look at Martin Brest, who directed movies like Beverly Hills Cop. I mean, he was a well-known quality director. But when he did a movie like Gigli in 2003, and it was such a notorious flop, it was famous for flopping, that is what killed his career, and he hasn't directed a movie since. So it's not just the women that this happens to. And now Noah Hawley getting an opportunity to direct again, yeah, sure. I mean, Lucy in the Sky was a crap movie. It was not a good film. But Lucy in the Sky also showed he could actually construct a film. And he's given an opportunity. And are women given the same opportunities? Not always, but it's not as one-sided as the narrative would want you to believe. Star Trek IV is a dangerous opportunity for anyone. And the reason for that is the last one was a flop compared to the series and almost killed the series. And this is its last chance. This is Star Trek's Terminator Dark Fate. If this does not work, it's going to soil his career. And this will be the second flop in as many movies as he's had. This is a huge risk for him to take. Now talk to me in a couple of years when Star Trek IV comes out, and if it doesn't do well, or if it does do well, then we can talk about his career afterwards. But let's not lean too much into the narrative that's being spun out there. Another piece of news involves a female director, is Elizabeth Banks has been tapped to star in and direct The Invisible Woman, which I find interesting because The Invisible Man, which is coming out under Blumhouse, hasn't even come out yet. And they're already doing The Invisible Woman. Now, if you actually go back and watch the original Invisible Woman from the Universal series, it's kind of a garbage movie anyways. It's not at the level of quality as The Invisible Man with Claude Rains or even The Return of The Invisible Man with Vincent Price. It's more along the line of The Invisible Spy. It's a little bit goofy. It's a little bit silly. And one of the problems with Elizabeth Banks is I think she's a better director than a director slash actor, but she always puts herself in her movies. And it works when you're doing something like the Pitch Perfect films, where you just have a one-shot side bit, than inserting yourself completely into the film, which is essentially what she did with the Charlie's Angels film. I think this is basically Elizabeth Banks' last chance. If she doesn't make this a decent movie, I don't know how many people are going to take her seriously as a director because she's had multiple chances to do big hits. And none of them have really clicked. Anything from Pitch Perfect 3 all the way down to Charlie's Angels. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to talk about, it's a funny trailer because it's just a bunch of noises and people making one-liners in period clothing, and that is Emma, which opens on February 21st.
We gather here in this time of man's great innocence.
Oh, Mr. Elton!
Emma.
Miss Woodhouse! Miss Woodhouse! Such news!
Now, this is, of course, based on the classic Jane Austen novel about a woman who doesn't want to be tied down and doesn't want to be married. This is playing up the whimsical nature of Jane Austen. And that's one of the things I don't think you get when Joe Wright does his Jane Austen versions of his movies. The Jane Austen movies are very lighthearted and fun and whimsical, and that's kind of one of the reasons why people like them so much. That's why the BBC has had such great success with making these as TV movies, much more than really the American studio versions of them as movies. So we'll see. This one has Anna Taylor-Joy in it, and I think she's a great up-and-coming actor. I'd like to see what happens, but this looks like it's trying to be fun and whimsical and silly, and that's really the essence of Jane Austen, I'd say, as a big fat guy in my late 40s who likes Star Wars movies. The next one I want to hit really quickly is The Way Back. Opens on March 6th.
Our basketball coach had a heart attack the other night. We need a new coach, Jack.
The last time we made the playoffs, back when you were playing.
Go, line up!
You're Marcus, right?
That's right.
How many threes did Marcus make last year?
A percentage of 26.
Damn.
Want to know why they're leaving you open? It's because they don't think you could hit the ocean from the beach.
So how are you liking coaching so far?
Great. Just getting used to the players.
What players?
I heard you're coaching basketball.
Yeah. Keeps me busy. Keeps my mind off other things.
This one stars Ben Affleck. This looks like it's a serious award bait movie. We've seen these movies before where you've got the depressed, introspective alcoholic who has to find a purpose in life. And of course, he does so by coaching this basketball team. And, you know, it might be good. It's just even watching the trailer, it's just like, I get it. The guy drinks beer all the time. I don't know. This looks very drab and dull and boring and heavy. And it does not necessarily look like a movie I'm going to be gravitating towards. I'm going to have to see it because it's coming out in theaters and I got to review it unless they don't screen it and hide it from me. But overall, a March 6th release for a movie like this, when it probably should be award bait, kind of makes me a little bit nervous. Anyways, let's move on and make some money with some commercials. And in the meantime, we'll be talking later about Queen and Slim and Motherless Brooklyn.
Stop it now.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
and welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Queen and Slim. A young black couple is stopped for a minor traffic incident, and they end up killing the officer in self-defense, then go on the run, which gains them infamy.
You failed to execute a turn signal back there.
Oh, my bad.
Step out of the vehicle.
Can I ask why, officer?
No, you may not.
Put your hands on your head and get on the ground now.
Are you serious?
Get on the ground!
Why is he under arrest?
Get back in the car!
I am an attorney!
Deal,
I'm
just
reaching for my cell phone!
Hey, is this y'all?
It's all over the news.
I support what y'all doing.
It was self-defense.
Power to the people.
Within the Black Bonnie and Clyde.
This is an interesting movie because of how it evolves as it goes through its running time. The first act of the film is really interesting because it's about this black couple on a date and they're getting to know each other, and then they get caught up in this traffic altercation that goes sour, and the officer shoots the woman, and then of course the guy reacts in self-defense and ends up killing the officer. And then they go on the run, and it turns into this Black Bonnie and Clyde type movie. It starts off in Cleveland, Ohio. And that's notable because there have been a couple of those officers shooting unarmed people of color. There have been a couple of them that have happened in Ohio. I'm from Ohio. I remember when there's one that happened in Cleveland at a park with a kid with a fake gun. And there was a couple down in Cincinnati that happened. So this stuff happens. It does. And they're very, very limited cases. But still, even if it's a limited case, you want to worry about it. So the first act has this great stuff where it's doing things that's a kind of classic. It's breaking the mold from what you would expect it would do. It's doing different things with the characters and some of their actions that are bold choices and have at times sometimes very humorous elements to it, as heavy as the subject matter is. But once the film becomes self-aware, somewhere in the second act, it loses cohesion. And that's when the movie starts to kind of fall apart, because at that point, when it becomes aware and it becomes about an issue rather than being about the characters, it is less of a movie, because what makes a movie work is its characters, the characters and the plot and the story. But the characters are what propels dramatic action and the story. And in a movie like Queen and Slim, once it becomes aware of that, it starts to turn in on itself. It starts to play into cliches. And it's trying to bite off something huge that's in the news nowadays, which is the treatment at times of people of color dealing with authority figures. And the thing I think is most interesting, look, you can sit there and deny that this stuff happens. It does. I mean, there's plenty of dash cam evidence and there's plenty of body cam evidence to show that these isolated incidents happened. And I think honestly, just from a standpoint, I think most people involved in law enforcement are good, upstanding citizens, and they're doing the right things. But there's always that small contingency of any way you slice a population, whether you go by race or sex or socioeconomic level or job, you're going to get bad apples in each job. There are racist cops out there. There just are. Just as there's racist plumbers and racist teachers and racist film critics and racist radio show hosts. And there are racist street sweepers and racist garbage men. And there are racist baristas out there. Every way you slice, you're going to get bad apples in there. The problem is that as a whole, you can't dismiss the bad actions of a few under the good actions of everyone else. And that's, I think, one of the problems that we run into. And that's why you get a disconnect racially when people look at issues like this. And I challenge anybody to go see Queen and Slim, not at your local theater where you feel safe. Go to the wrong end of town. Go to the area that you would normally avoid. And go see it in a room full of people of color. And see how they react to it. And one thing I've learned over my years, in my short time on Earth, is that when there's a group of people that feel marginalized or that they feel that they are being victimized, you got to listen to them, because even if they're not 100% accurate with their feelings, and their feelings may be unwarranted, there's a reason they're happening. And that needs to be examined and affected and changed. and just telling people, oh, don't worry about it. Because here's the thing. I'm sure I've run into racist cops before, but I would never know. Why? Because I'm not a black guy. And that goes for anybody, whether it's a police officer at a traffic stop, or like I said, whether it's a plumber or a barista, or, you know, somebody who's making change for you at McDonald's. I think the greater issue with Queen and Slim is the reaction of its audience. I happen to see it in a predominantly black audience. And it was interesting to see their reaction to what was going on the screen. And it would be ignorant and stupid of me to look at the audience and be like, well, you just need to respect officers. When many of them have possibly interacted in situations that I have no idea what I'd be speaking about. So while Queen and Slim isn't that great of a movie, and it does become self-aware and cobble itself in the process, it's still a worthwhile movie to see and to bring a discussion, because there are things that are happening in our society that really shouldn't be happening. So ultimately, Queen and Slim gets a kind of rocks, even if the greater message supersedes the movie itself.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I ran really long on Queen and Slims, but that's okay, because I'm going to talk about Motherless Brooklyn here for a second. This is a movie, it's been out for a couple weeks, and it's almost virtually gone from the theaters because it didn't do terribly well. But it's award season. I've gotten some screeners for it. I've been wanting to see it, and so I think I'm going to review it here now. Edward Norton directs and stars in this film about a man with Tourette's syndrome who investigates government corruptions in 1940s New York.
I got something wrong with me.
I got threads in my head.
I twitch and shout a lot, but inside my head's an even bigger mess. I can't stop twisting things around. Then I started working for Frank. Frank Minna, Private Eye. He gave me a place in this crappy world.
Does anybody know what Frank was into on this?
There's something going down, and it's big, and they were not happy about what he found.
We find who did this, and we square accounts.
If I figure it out, I'm gonna make him regret it. I promise you that.
This is apparently a book that Edward Norton has been trying to make into a movie for like 2 decades. And it seems like it's trying to make a message about stuff that happened 70 years ago in New York, which was 50 years ago when the book came out. But it's something that happened in the past in New York that was unfair. And it shows the heart of corruption. But a lot of things get in the way. The big thing is Edward Norton's character as somebody with Tourette's syndrome, it seems like that typical thing we saw in the 2000s with TV shows where they said, let's put an autistic person in here, and then they're going to be special, and we can use them as a great conduit for the story. And that's what I feel like in this. There's no reason this guy needs to be having an overactive mind. It's just a way for the writer to make it look interesting. And while it may have been inclusive back when the book was written, it seems sort of hokey and forced and a cheap plot point in this one. Overall, the design is good. The production design is good. The background looks good. It drags. It's not a terribly interesting story, and it kind of loops around itself. Motherless Brooklyn is not doing terribly well, and there's a reason for that. It's kind of a slag of a film. So while it has some nice production value, overall, the movie itself just doesn't have the push to get it past the finish line. I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Knives Out and the Two Popes.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with the big one that's going to be hitting this weekend, and that is Knives Out. Rian Johnson writes and directs this whodunit about a wealthy patriarch who commits suicide and a detective who comes in to root out any foul play.
We understand the night of his demise, the family have gathered to celebrate your father's 85th birthday. How was it, by the way?
The party? Pre my dad's death? Oh, it was great.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to request that you all stay until the investigation is completed.
What?
Can we ask why? Has something changed?
No.
No, it hasn't changed, or no, we can't ask.
I've heard a lot of people compare this to Clue, and I caution people in framing it that way. The reason I think people are comparing it to Clue is because it takes place in a, you know, in a mansion, you know, a nice stained wood house with like secret passages and stuff. And it feels like a Clue movie where you got all the suspects together and there's a study and there's a conservatory and you have different rooms and potentially different murder weapons. Here's why it's not Clue. Clue was a comedy, and it was a broad comedy back in the 80s. If you remember watching it, it had Michael McKean in it, it had Madeline Kahn, and it had all these comedic actors from the 80s. It was not a serious whodunit. Knives Out is a serious whodunit. You're not going to find three different endings on this movie. And while there's a lot of humor in it, it's very dark humor and sardonic humor that's buried into the story, not this overt, over-the-top, in-your-face humor that you will get in a movie like Clue. So Knives Out is a whodunit. It feels much more like a high production value version of something you would have seen on the TV show Mystery on PBS back in the 80s. I remember my mother is a huge mystery fan, from reading Agatha Christie books to watching BBC movies. She loves the Brother Cadfael books and the whole series of Brother Cadfael. There's multiple versions of it. And she'll watch stuff like Murder, She Wrote, which is the cheesy TV series that you can usually guess the ending to. And it's not terribly well written, but she loves that kind of stuff. She loves that the way I love cheesy horror movies from the 80s. That's the kind of movie this is for. There's not a whole lot of whodunits that are done in the big screen because they can be very formulaic and they do have a limited audience. This is well written and it's laid out and it works and it has some very sardonically funny moments. It has some good twists and turns in it. It has a fantastic cast. Everyone from Jamie Lee Curtis and Christopher Plummer and Don Johnson, you know, all the way down to Ana de Maris, who is gorgeous and normally playing a much sexier vixen. She was, of course, in most recognizably the Blade Runner sequel that came out a couple years ago, where she was a computer-generated lover, basically. But she plays a much more mild-mannered, mousy character in this one. You've got Chris Evans in it. You've got Toni Collette. You've got Don Johnson. Did I mention him already? You've got Daniel Craig as the detective who's trying to figure out whether there's foul play or not. One of the things that Rian Johnson does is he likes to take genres and archetypes and either mash them up. For example, when he did Brick, he basically took film noir and applied that to a high school drama. He, of course, did Looper, which was a time travel movie, which he was trying to be a bit iconoclastic on. Obviously, when he did The Last Jedi, and I think he failed with The Last Jedi because he was trying to be iconoclastic in the middle of trying to make a franchise series. That's why I think he failed with The Last Jedi, because The Last Jedi was not ready to be broken up as a genre piece. It still existed in its genre and it got ahead of itself. But that's what Rian Johnson likes to do. He likes to play around with existing genres and archetypes. I think he does a good job here. Ultimately, it's just a basic whodunit. It's a mystery with twists and turns and suspects, but the thing that really carries it is a fantastic cast and some clever writing here and there. But a lot of it's also just the atmosphere. I mean, it's this old dark house with lots of stained wood and secret passages and murder weapons around every corner. You've got dogs, you know, the hounds, release the hounds, Smithers. You've got the cameras and a large palatial estate where anybody can hide. So yeah, there's a lot about it that makes it fun to watch. It's a little bit predictable, and the twists and turns, I think if you start thinking about them too much, it does collapse like a house of cards. When you get the final reveal, you're like, I don't know if that totally works, but it's good enough for what I want to see. It's not perfect, but it's still a fun little lark of a film and worth checking out. If you've fought with your family at Thanksgiving, now is a time to go watch a family on screen fight with each other and possibly murder each other. So I'm going to have to say Knives Out kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the two popes. Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce star in this character study of Pope Benedict grooming his successor to head the Catholic Church.
I cannot play this role anymore. There's a saying, God always corrects one pope by presenting the world with another pope. I'd like to see my correction.
Reform needs a politician. The most important qualification for any leader is not wanting to be leader.
It's not me who needs to be satisfied. It's 1.2 billion believers.
You're the right person. Just needs to change, and you could be that change.
It could never be me.
This is another one of those movies that's being released by Netflix. It's getting a limited theatrical release. So right now it's being released in theaters. You can find it around the country. It's in limited release. I think December 20th is when it releases on Netflix. But ultimately it's about the real meetings that took place between Pope Benedict and the would-be Pope Francis. And the thing with this is you think, oh, you know, it's just about Pope and a cardinal talking to each other. But here's the thing. It is a charming, wonderful, beautiful movie, has a lot of incredible humor to it. And a lot of that's due to the fact that you've got Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce in the two roles. And they are such good actors, and they're so seasoned to what they do, and they're so good at embodying these characters that they can bring out the humanity to them. And it brings up some of the issues that are going on in the Catholic Church with the reform and and progressing it out of a more archaic time, which Benedict represented that archaic traditional view, and Pope Francis is a little more open and progressive and wanting to maybe make some reforms in the Catholic Church, and maybe that's needed. I'm not Catholic, so I don't have a say in that. But I think it's a beautifully done movie. It's ultimately Jonathan Pryce's movie as the would-be Pope Francis. Because it's him ultimately just wanting to, his purpose in the movie is he wants to quit being a cardinal and go back to just being a street priest in Buenos Aires. But it's Benedict who sees that he's not able to fulfill the more reforming elements of the church that seems to be leaning towards it on a global level. And he wants to preserve he wants to preserve the possibility of somebody who can do that. And it touches on certain things. It skirts around the whole child abuse issue. I mean, it confronts it, but it doesn't confront the details of it, because it's not about the details at this point. It's about the church's position on it and whether the church wants to actually fix and help things. And a lot of it is manufactured. I had an opportunity to travel out to LA and talk to the writer and talk to the producers of this. And there's a lot of stuff. They don't know exactly what was said between these two guys, but they know where they come from idealistically and spiritually and theologically. There's a lot of notes about their conversations, and they could sort of recreate a dramatic version of what they said to each other. And it's a beautiful movie. Does have some flashbacks that go back to Francis's period as a young man. Those tend to drag because it doesn't have Jonathan Pryce or Anthony Hopkins in it. When the two of them are on screen, it really propels the movie. But it is a gorgeous looking movie, and when they finally come back on screen, they're vibrant and warm and expressive and fun and entertaining and humorous. And this is really one of those fly under the radar kind of movies that's worth seeing. It's got a message that transcends the actual religion of the characters within it. So I'm going to have to say The Two Popes totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to do a quick look at A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood and then review Klaus, have the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Prophecy.
Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track, and you can get anything you want at Alice's.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish things up with movie reviews. I'm going to do a real quick sort of side review. I'm not even playing a trailer. You want to hear a trailer for this? Go back to last week. And you can find the trailer for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. It was a weird thing that they didn't screen it locally for me, so I couldn't see it prior to its release. So I had a chance to watch it because I was very interested in this because I grew up with Fred Rogers. I grew up watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And I talked about this last year when the movie Won't You Be My Neighbor came out, the documentary about Fred Rogers. And so this was very important for me to look at A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood and encapsulate it for what it is. Now, the way this movie is structured. It is not a biopic of Fred Rogers. Do not go in expecting to see his life and times. This is the story about a writer who is assigned to profile him in Esquire magazine. The character's name's Lloyd. It's played by Matthew Rhys from The Americans and from Brothers and Sisters. And what happens is Rogers tends to turn the tables on him and, you know, helps him look at himself and find forgiveness in his own life. So it's really Lloyd's story. It's not Fred Rogers' story, and that's okay. But you got to go in knowing that. You know, you're not getting a biopic of Fred Rogers. Tom Hanks does a great job as Mr. Rogers. He embodies the warmth and the soul, even though he doesn't look terribly like Fred Rogers or even sound like Fred Rogers. He has that cadence of speech, and he captures the essence of Mr. Rogers. And that essence being somebody who is leading by example in everything he does. And at times doesn't always work, and at times will fail. But that's okay, because that's what Fred Rogers tells the kids that he connects with. It's okay if you mess up. You're a different person, and you're a wonderful person, you're special. And that's the message that Fred Rogers always had, and he kept with him. And in watching this movie, as somebody who watched the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood as a kid, you're finding yourself, you're just like crying as you're watching the movie. Tears are streaming on your cheeks as you're watching this film, and you don't know why, because it's touching you in this emotional core. And then by the time they get to the third act, it kind of just... Fred Rogers checks out, and it's about this Lloyd character, and it's okay. And it's then, of course, when he comes back, it's wonderful again. A great performance by Tom Hanks by not becoming the character, but by capturing the heart and soul and the essence. Rhys does a great job in it as well. It's a good movie. It's worth seeing, especially if you're a fan or grew up with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So I have to take back my preemptive suck from last week. I'm going to have to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk briefly about Klaus. This animated film tells the story of Santa Claus's origin in a bitter town in which the children want to send letters to receive gifts of toys.
Mr. Klaus, you have a gift. You were meant for making toys. So I figured if you donate your old toys, I'll deliver them for free.
Our cousin told us if we write a letter to Mr. Klaus, he'll make us a toy.
Hey, what do you guys think you're doing? This is Smearensburg, the unhappiest place on Earth. And you two can't change that.
We've seen these origins of Santa Claus before, and everything from Santa Claus is Coming to Town to the movie Santa Claus the Movie by the Salkinds in the 80s. But this is an interesting take on it, taking it from the perspective of the postman who finds Santa Claus in the first place. And the postman is voiced by Jason Schwartzman, who learns that these kids in this town want to receive toys, and they want to be acknowledged for who they are, because the parents are always fighting. They have two different factions in this town, and this postman takes the letters to Santa, and Santa gives them presents, and each one has to learn about themselves. It's a sweet little movie, and it is something that's worth checking out. It's a great family viewing. It's on Netflix right now. I think it was in theaters earlier this month, but it's on Netflix. It's been on Netflix for about a week. And it is a charming holiday feature that is a little bit unique and has a lot of fun and has this a very stylized animation that looks fresh and original and different. It doesn't look just like a knockoff of Disney. And it's a sweet story that'll get you in the Christmas spirit. So I'm going to have to say that Klaus, as a children's film and as a film for the whole family, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office. Last week, it was not a big surprise that Frozen won. But Frozen won considerably well. It did extremely, extremely well. It made $130 million over the weekend, which was on the high end of what they were expecting. I was waiting to see if it slowed down a little bit, because it may have been front-loaded, because it was aiming to a specific market and it was a sequel. It did not slow down. $130 million in fantastic. Even though it's not as good of a movie as the original Frozen, it still is a big hit for Disney and another big movie, and it's probably going to reach $1 billion overseas. And A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood came in third behind Ford versus Ferrari. The rest of the stuff kind of trickled in last. But the big hit this last weekend was, of course, Frozen 2, which was a massive hit. And this one's important because it's not Marvel, it's not Star Wars, and it's not Pixar. It is fully homegrown as a Disney film. So this is a big win for Disney. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is on Prophecy, which is a movie from 1979. It's a monster movie. And what's funny is when you go to the special features on there, you hear everybody talking about how the director, John Frankenheimer, one of the most famous directors of all time, did a crappy monster movie because he was battling alcoholism at the time pretty heavily, but he made this movie that he insisted on set never be called a monster movie, but literally on the poster it says Prophecy, the monster movie. And in this film, an environmental scientist travels to a Maine paper mill to investigate the effect of pollution in the local wildlife.
It is not the offspring of witchcraft or Satan. It was created by man. It will grow to be 15 feet tall. It will have huge eyes, webbed hands, hooked claws. It will walk upright. And it will mindlessly, mercilessly kill every living thing it meets.
What's interesting about this movie is I saw it the day after I saw Dark Waters, which is a movie I'll be talking about in coming weeks. It's an award film. Stars Mark Ruffalo as a real-life guy who goes down to Parkersburg, West Virginia, and investigates DuPont leaching chemicals into the groundwater and the worry that it had on people in their water supply. And the thing is, water is so important, and we see this happen all the time. You get the Flint water crisis. I remember there was a West Virginia water crisis going on. I was once driving through West Virginia, and we made a point not to stop in one of the towns because of the water was bad. And you, of course, had the Aaron Brockovich story. So water is very important, and there are people that do pollute the water supply. And it's so unnerving that you're watching this movie from 1979, that's 40 years ago, and you're still dealing with these kind of issues of heavy metals and poisonous chemicals and forever chemicals being leached into the water supply. Now, when it comes to Prophecy, the movie, like I said, it's a monster movie made in 1979, and it starts off, there's a lot of environmental horror movies back from the 70s, and this starts out in that sense, and it kind of has an interesting cast. It's got like Talia Shire in it, which you'd expect to be a little bit higher class movie, but it just turns into ultimately a giant mutant bear that is attacking everybody. And it's not that great of a movie. It's fun to watch in the when animal attacks level. It'd be a great pairing with a movie like Grizzly. Lots of fun, overly silly once the monster shows up, and then it just becomes this guy in a big rubber bear suit attacking people. And it's weirdly violent for a PG movie. It was rated PG in 1979. What's fascinating about it is the special features. The bonus content on it involves a lot of interviews with everyone from Talia Shire to the special effects people, to the writer David Seltzer, who wrote The Omen, who was very popular in the 70s, all talking about how it was not really a great movie, and that once they decided to go with the big rubber bear suit, it completely loses cohesion. And so it's interesting to watch those special features because it is a lot of people involved in the cast and crew kind of dogging the movie, but it is a fun look at the past. It's a 40-year-old movie. I find those to be a lot of fun to watch because they're goofy and they're silly, and they remind me a little bit of my childhood. There's a TV spot about people camping and a kid hopping away in a sleeping bag that always unnerved me as a kid. But overall, Prophecy is, it's not a great movie, but it's fun in the context of being a 40-year-old monster movie. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other movies that are out this week on DVD and Blu-ray include The RoboCop Collector Set, Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Gauntlet, which is essentially season 12, along with the Dracula movie from 1979, also out on Blu-ray for the first time. That is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Playmobil, the movie, The Aeronauts, and Dark Waters. Have a happy turkey day, and I hope you stuffed your face as much as you can. Until next time, have a fat time at the movies.